Good morning to all. Certainly a pleasure to be here to study a portion of God's Word, to worship together, and glad to see everybody that's here. I have a great crowd this morning. It's just going to be a great, terrific Lord's Day. For a little while this morning, I have a lesson that I've entitled, For a Nominal Fee. We're studying from the book of John this week, or this month, really for the next couple of months as we go through the Gospel of John. I have a little story to tell you this morning. It comes from John, the second chapter, verses 13 through 17. John 2, 13 through 17. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers doing business. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. And then his disciples remembered that it was written, Zeal for your house has eaten me up. So we're going to study this story, kind of get some historical background on it. And as we study this portion of the... It's kind of a strange scene of Jesus in a way, because we see Jesus as always being under control. We see Jesus as being, you know, peaceful and loving and non-confrontational. And boy, all of a sudden, here's Jesus with the cord chasing sheep and goat out of the temple. He's flipping over tables. There's money flying everywhere. And Jesus is, he's downright irate with what was going on in the temple. So we get kind of a different perspective of the Savior this morning in our sermon. Let's take time right now to go to God in a word of prayer, and then we're going to come back and study this concept for a nominal fee. Well, as we study our sermon this morning, I want to answer seven questions. And if we kind of keep these seven questions in mind, I think it'll help us to give us a better understanding of this passage. Number one, how many times did Jesus cleanse the temple? And that's kind of what it's referred to usually in literature, that he cleansed the temple. How many times did this happen? Number two, where in the temple did this action actually occur? Number three, was there a need for the animals during Passover? Number four, why were money changers necessary? Number five, did doves represent peace? Number six, was the system corrupt? And finally, number seven, what did the disciples think of all of this? Now, there's a great question. How many times did Jesus cleanse the temple? Was it once or was it twice? What we're reading from this morning is from John, the second chapter. That is the very beginning of the ministry of Jesus. And so we read this account, John chapter 2. And then there's another account that's given in Matthew 21, Mark 11, and Luke 19 that are towards the end of the ministry. In fact, it's all during the last week of the life of Jesus after the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And so there's some question. Some of the biblical scholars think, well, maybe this was actually the same event, and the writers has kind of put it out of chronological order, which from time to time the writers did. And so the question is, did he do this action? Did he chase all the animals and turn the tables over once, or did he do it twice? Let me give you the second account. This is from Luke 19, verse 45, and then he went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in it, saying to them, It is written, My house is a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. And he was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests, the scribes, and the leaders of the people sought to destroy him, and were unable to do anything, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. So the question then becomes, is this the same event that we read in John 2? And what appears to be at the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, and this is in the last week of the life of Jesus, is this somehow just some sort of a... chronological, not necessarily error, but just an anachronism placed out of time that the writers chose to do it. I'm going to go with that it's twice. I'm going to go with it's two separate events. I think they're very similar, but it appears that they're separated by about 3 years. There's a couple hints. One is from John chapter 2, just the words themselves. If you read in John chapter 2, verse 11, this is right after the miracle at Cana. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. In verse 12 it says, And after this he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they did not stay there many days. Verse 13, Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So it has some words like after this, and now was at hand, and it just appears that it's chronological. And so it appears to me that just the timing words used by John tell me it's probably two different events. Now Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they also don't mention the scourge or the whip that Jesus made, so it kind of tells me it's two separate events. And then finally, in John chapter 2, people kind of saw it, but they didn't immediately confront him. It kind of says they just kind of backed off. In the other accounts, as soon as it happened, the chief priests were right on to Jesus trying to figure out what was going on. So I'm going to go with there were actually two separate events. One at the beginning of the ministry that we're going to talk about this morning. And then there's another event, very, very similar, in the last life of Jesus Christ. So where in the temple did all this occur? I want you to, that's quite a visual scene. I've always liked this story because it's so visual. Can you imagine Jesus making a cord with a scourge? I don't know what he tied into then. I imagine he found a stick of some sort sitting around and then maybe tied pieces of cloth, or maybe he found some leather, or I don't know. Maybe he found some twigs, maybe what we would call more of a switch than what he would call as a scourge. I don't know. But he found something, and here's Jesus going up with this little whip, chasing all these animals out of the temple, chasing sheep, chasing these oxen and all of their herders. He said they're chasing around with the whip. Then he runs over and he flips over a table and money just scatters everywhere. And then he starts hollering at somebody that were selling doves. This is one of the most visual scenes that we have really in the scriptures. And it gives us a completely different insight to the type of person that Jesus was. This is what we like to call righteous indignation. And a lot of times people will use this example when they say, you know, there are times where it's okay to get upset. You know, the Bible says, be not angry and sin not. Well, see, you can be angry sometimes, see? It's okay sometimes to be angry if it's righteous. And remember what Jesus did in the temple, how he flipped over the table? And it's just a very visual scene. I've always liked this. But where in the temple did this happen? Was it in the sanctuary? Probably not. The word temple can be used both as a generic and a specific sense. And you can talk about the entire temple, meaning the entire complex. And people estimate it was about 30 acres. So I kind of have a visual of that because the house we used to live at was on 10 acres. And we used about an acre of it, and the rest of it was just all pasture land. So I kind of have an idea of what 10 acres would be. Okay, so I triple that. I kind of have a vision in my mind of what the size of the temple complex. Or you might talk about the temple and mean very, very specific, the actual building. I found a real cool picture here. Kind of an idea of what the temple used to look like in the time of Jesus. So would you call this the temple? Because that's the temple proper up there. That's the actual temple where we've got the holy place and the most holy place, and that's where the priests ministered. But this whole compound would be considered the temple in a more general sense. And so you see this area out here where it's all open? That was known as the court of the Gentiles. And anybody could go into the court of the Gentiles. So you can imagine just kind of walking into this complex. You could walk up this little walkway. Every kind of reminds me of that Jones AT&T football stadium in Lubbock, to be honest. Kind of what it reminds me of, kind of that big concourse you walk into. These buildings over here, this is where the Sanhedrin court met. And so then you have this whole area over here. This highest point right here, at the peak of that roof, was called the pinnacle of the temple. You may have heard that before when Satan was tempting Jesus. But anyway, you had this whole complex in here. This was known as the court of the Gentiles. I'm guessing that's where all the activity occurred. So it wasn't in the temple proper, so to speak. And historical accounts kind of back this up, that it was probably in this outer area. Then you would enter into the temple, this area right here, that was called the court of the women. So Jewish women could enter into that area. Gentiles, you had to stop. You had to stop right here. You weren't allowed to go into the temple proper. In fact, there's a big old sign on the door that said, if you're a Gentile and you enter, you can be executed. So the Gentiles didn't mess around in that part. Women could go this far, and now this is where we get into the part where the activities really occurred. This is where the sacrifices occurred. We had the holy place, and then inside of that was the most holy place. And so each section got more restrictive. Everyone can enter the court of the Gentiles, then just the Jews, then just Jewish men, then just priests, and then just the high priest. So each little group kind of got more and more restricted. So the activity of the day, I'm assuming, occurred in the court of the Gentiles. So imagine this whole area just being surrounded by vendors. Just imagine. Animals everywhere. I read in one account at least 3,000 sheep would have been brought in for at least per day, was the writing. It was kind of hard to follow. But imagine this whole area being just surrounded with sheep and oxen and people selling doves. And then you have the money changers. And in my mind, it reminds me of kind of the old Fiesta del Concho. That's what I have in my mind of all the vendors set up on the side of the road. And I'm sure if there's people selling sheep and there's people selling oxen, there's also people selling lemonade and foot-long corn dogs and whatever they can come up with. It was like a carnival-type atmosphere. There are people just flooding into the city of Jerusalem from all over the world. And I'm sure it's pretty interesting. I would assume that most of us in some time in our life, you've probably been to a conference or a convention. And maybe for work and you go to the exhibit hall. That's kind of what this was like. Loud, people selling their wares, people trying to hawk, kind of like at the carnival to try to get you to come guess your weight or whatever it might be. A lot of going back and forth. Imagine the animals. Imagine the bleeding of the sheep. Imagine the mooing of the cows or whatever you might have, the chirping of the birds. You know, there's a stereotype too about the Jewish people that they enjoy a good haggle. So I want you to imagine the haggling going back and forth over the price that are going to be, what it's going to cost to purchase these animals. Oh, and the smells. Could you imagine the smell of all those animals? You ever go to the stock yard, to the stock barns out at a stock show and rodeo? Oh, there is a distinct smell all surrounding the temple of the Lord. So I'm guessing that's where it occurred from. From a later Passover, just a couple years later, we use this account when we talk about speaking of tongues, but this is from Acts, the second chapter. Have you ever thought about where all the people came from? They just descended upon Jerusalem. Parthians and Medes and Elamites, those in Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, Libya, Cyrene, Rome, Cretans, Arabs. People from all over the world had converged upon Jerusalem for the Passover. I found this neat little map right here. You ever thought about this? From all over the world, Jews returned to Jerusalem for the Passover. So there were people from everywhere. So now that we understand why there was a need for animals, you ever thought about that? There was a need for these animals. In Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter, verse 1, this was a command given to the Jews. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God a bull or sheep which has any blemish or defect, for that is an abomination to the Lord your God. So every Jewish male, 20 years old and up, had to sacrifice there in the city of Jerusalem, and they had to sacrifice a bull or a sheep without blemish or defect. Here's my question. Who decided what was a blemish or what was a defect? How did you decide from your flock if it had a blemish or a defect? Well, it had to be certified. The priest had to make that decision. Well, now we've got people coming in from all over the world, and they had to make a decision. What if you took your sheep and you came from one of those far-off places and you got all the way up to the line to sacrifice and the priest said, sorry, we can't do this one. It's got a blemish. It has a defect. What would you do? Have you ever had to have anyone inspect your work? Have you ever built a house and had to have an inspector come out and inspect it? If your plumbing is right, or if your sewage is right, or is this structurally sound, and you're counting on someone to inspect that. And sometimes you agree with their decision, and sometimes you don't. But they're the ones that have the magic pen that signs off on the paper, so whatever they say is right is what is right. So I'm going to give you some words now Karen gave me a book a long time ago. It's by a man named Edersheim. And it is about that thick. It's called The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. Real little bitty words. And that's just volume one. I don't know how many volumes of that book there are. This guy, I guess he was a professor at Oxford. It is in-depth analysis of the ways of Judaism in the time of Jesus. An outstanding book. That's where a lot of this comes from. So we need somebody that can inspect. I say it. M-U-M-C-H-E-H. That's the Hebrew word. And today, that word still has meaning. It's in Hebrew what you call an expert. So you had to have someone that was an expert that had been trained to determine whether you had a blemish or defect in your animal. So if you're a pilgrim, you got two options. Number one, you could bring your own animal. You could bring your own bull or your own sheep or your own doves, but they had to be inspected by a priest-appointed monk checker. I don't know how you say it. But you had to have an agent of the priest inspected. So who is this guy working for? The priest. So I would assume that every time they certified an animal, the priest got a little bit of a cut because this was not free. Not free at all. You had to pay a fee for this inspector to inspect your animal, and then the kickback went back to the priest. Or, option two, you could buy a previously certified animal from one of these priest-approved vendors out in the courtyard for a nominal fee, of course. See? It's a racket. These priests had it figured out. You got two options. Either you bring your own animal, but one of the priest-appointed munchas has to inspect it, and the little kickback goes back to the priesthood. Or you can buy a previously certified animal. And guess who was making the money off of the nominal fee? You guessed it, the priest. So things had really gotten into quite a pretty good plan here for the priest. My mind went to here. This is the worst thing that's ever occurred in my life. If you've flown, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Have you ever had to go through airport security checkpoints? It is the worst thing in the world. If you've only flown out of San Angelo, you have no idea. Our security checklist, it's usually the same guy. He takes your ticket, and then he walks back, and then he does the inspection. Go to a big airport. Go to DFW. Or fly out of the one in Atlanta, Denver. We've flown out of LAX. Oh, it's horrible. You may stand in this line for hours and hours. And then you get up to the TSA agent, and there's no telling what they might have you do. They have all the power. They may let you walk through. They may have you do a little wand, and you have to stand here, and they wand you. If they want to, they can take you in a room and do a further search. Oh, it is not pleasant. But they're in charge. But you know you can get out of those lines? Did you know that for a small nominal fee, they have what's called this TSA pre-check? I don't know if you've ever noticed that at the airport. If you are in the TSA pre-check group for a small nominal fee, of course, then you can skip those lines and not have to go through those security. You can go through a different, faster security and skip the lines. Well, the priest kind of had that figured out too. If you want to bring your own animal, that's fine. You can stand in line with your animal, and you can have with hundreds and thousands of other pilgrims kind of stand in a line like this until someone inspects your animal. Or, for a small nominal fee, of course, you can escape those lines, skip the lines, and come by a previously certified animal that the priest have already guaranteed is spotless, has no blemish. Could you imagine making commercials for this group if they had the ability back in those days? Can you imagine how you can make a commercial and you show the poor old guy just loaded up and he's dirty and filthy and he's got his animal in one hand and his kid on the other and he's just packed in this room with thousands of people waiting to be inspected, and then it probably flashes to a black and white still of him just sitting there with this horrible exasperated look up on his face. And then all of a sudden in bright colors, here comes a guy that shows up on his camel, gets up, snaps his fingers, and some smiling, happy young person does curbside delivery, just brings his animal right up to him, and off he goes, and trade it, Trader Jack's next time for all your Passover needs. And I can just imagine the commercial, how you can make this look The priest had it figured out. And they were making money off of every transaction that came into the temple. I don't think that's what God had planned. I don't think that's what God had designed. Why money changers? What do we need money changers for? Well, Exodus 30 and 13, this is what everyone among those who are numbered shall give, half a shekel, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, the half shekel shall be an offering to the Lord. Had to be a half shekel. There were all sorts of different coins. Remember all those places people were coming from? They each had their own coins. They each had their own money. They each had their own denominations, and not all of it was the same. And sometimes it had to be based upon the amount of silver that was found in the coin. So you had to weigh it out to see if people were trying to cheat you. Nehemiah also made ordinances for ourselves to exact from ourselves nearly one-third of a shekel. So somewhere between Exodus to Nehemiah, it went from a half to a third. And I don't know why Nehemiah changed that. Maybe it's just because they were coming back from Babylon and nobody had any money. I don't know. But now we're back to the time of Jesus, and it's a half shekel. So you have to have a half shekel. But what happens if you didn't have shekels? What happened if your part of the world didn't deal in shekels? They dealt in a different type of coinage. Well, just like you do at the border, you'd have to go exchange your money for the money of the land. And so you'd have to go transfer your money from American dollars into shekels. And luckily, there was somebody waiting to do that for a small nominal fee. They would change your money for them. Any other type of coinage was not accepted and had to be exchanged for shekels for the temple tax. And if you didn't pay with the temple tax, then you had problems with the leaders. You had to pay with the shekel. So the purpose of the money changes. Here you go. This is all from Edersham again. And I tried to figure it out. I'm telling you, he's way above my pay grade trying to figure out his writing, but I do the best I can. Remember, it was on the 15th day of Nisan. Was when the Passover was. Go back a month. It's the 15th day of Adar. A month before the Passover, there was kind of like early voting. They had an early exchange period where people would start coming into Jerusalem. They would set up out in the outlying countryside. And these people would set up their little booths to exchange money. They had a name. Again, I can't pronounce that. Shokanim. They were considered the money exchangers. They had to be certified. Guess who certified it? The priest. So the priesthood, again, has their hands in everything. So they have certified these money changers to make sure that the money they're getting is legit. And then they would exchange it for the shekel. On the 25th day of Adar, so you had a 10-day period, you could do it on the outskirts, like early voting. But on the 25th, all these folks moved into the temple. And they set up their little tables there in the temple, most likely in the court of the Gentile. And so if you wanted to exchange money, you're more than able to, as long as you had what's called a moa, I suppose, and it's just a type of coin. That was the exchange rate. You had to pay a small nominal fee to have your money exchanged into the temple tax. And they had a fancy word here again. I thought Hughes had to have used after it, apparently not in Hebrew. I don't know how you pronounce that, a koban or whatever. That was a nominal fee for the exchange. And who do you think got that money? It went to the priest. For a small nominal fee? Oh, by the way, that koban, that small nominal fee, according to Edersheim, was somewhere from about a fourth to a half of the actual amount of the tax that was owed. So let's say you owed $100 in tax. You'd have to convert that into shekels, and the fee would be $50 to convert it into shekels. Somebody is making a killing. Even better, if you needed change from the money changers, if you didn't have an exact amount and you needed change, you had to pay a double nominal fee. It's kind of like the old shipping and handling charges, where it's only $9.99 to buy something, but the shipping and handling is $28. Now you know why. I think they learned it from the priest back in the first century. Add that to the fee paid to your animal inspector, and all of a sudden you have spent a ton of money in taxes and administrative fees. And guess where all that extra money is going to? It's going back to the priest. I think the word is racket that I'm thinking of right now. It is a money-making scheme designed by the priest. Exodus 22 and 25. Let me turn to Exodus 22 and 25. Something just doesn't sound right here. Exodus 22 and 25. This is from the law of Moses. If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a moneylender to him. You shall not charge him interest. So they weren't allowed to charge interest when a child of Israel, an Israelite, loaned money to another Israelite. Well, it stands to reason, and then you wouldn't want to make a killing off of them when they came to sacrifice either. But they considered that kind of a loophole, and so they hit them with all these taxes and administrative fees. Now, do you see why Jesus is a little bit irate with some of these people? What do doves represent? You know, because some were selling doves there in the sanctuary, or in the temple. In our culture, the releasing of doves represents love. It represents peace. You know, I found this picture. That's one I was thinking of in my head when I looked for a picture. You know, it's the dove of peace. He's the olive branch of peace. That's kind of what I think of doves. You release doves. You see it all the time. Like the Olympics, they'll release doves. It's a symbol of peace and understanding. I don't really recall this, but it said through most parts of the world, releasing doves at a wedding because it's a symbol of everlasting love. I don't know that I've ever seen that one. That must not be popular out here in West Texas. Somebody probably shoot them, I guess. But apparently that is something across the world that is kind of famous. What about during the time of Jesus? Is that what doves represented? Did doves represent peace? Did doves represent love? And the answer is no. Not at all. Leviticus, the 14th chapter, explains it. Verse 21. But if he is poor and cannot afford it, then he shall take one male lamb as a trespass offering. So it starts out with the bull. If you're too poor to have a bull, you are allowed to offer a lamb. If you're too poor to have a lamb, verse 22, and two turtle doves or two young pigeons, such as he is able to afford. Doves represented poverty. This was also the case for a destitute mother. On the eighth day after childbirth, you were supposed to present that child and offer a sacrifice. Same way. A bull. If you're too poor to have a bull, you offered a lamb. If you were too poor to offer a lamb, you had to offer two doves. Doves represented poverty. If you've read through the Old Testament, the law of Moses, there are a couple groups of people you don't mess with. Elderly, the young, the widows, the orphans, and the poor. Do not mess with people. Do not take advantage of people that are in a bad situation. That was across the law of Moses. Deuteronomy 15 and 11, for the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to your poor and your needy in your land. You did not, under the law of Moses, take advantage of the poor. You did not take advantage of those that could not take care of themselves. So what do those two doves represent? Poverty. You ever thought about that? Probably heard that song a whole bunch here in the last week. Two turtle doves and a partridge in a pear tree. What are those two turtle doves? What's that mean? What are those two doves? What's the meaning of that? Why is that in that song? Well, according to Luke, the second chapter, verse 24, when Mary brought Jesus to the temple after 8 days, guess what they sacrificed? Was it a bull? No, they didn't have money for a bull. Was it a lamb? No, they didn't have enough money for a lamb. It was two turtle doves. It was two pigeons. So apparently the carpentry industry was not going too well for Joseph. They didn't have any money. They were poor. So I've always wondered if this part of the story, did Jesus have a little bit added incentive to go after those that were selling doves? Because they were taking advantage of poor people. Not only that, they were taking advantage of poor, destitute women who had just given birth. And I wonder in the back of his mind if Jesus didn't remember about almost 30 years earlier, some of them same people had done the same thing to his mother. I've always wondered if that was kind of in the back of his mind.
Who knows? Was the system corrupt?
I don't know. I wasn't there. I can't say.
But it sure appears to be corrupt.
And if it was corrupt, it sure had the opportunity to be corrupt. It was a kickback system. And it appears from the action of Jesus that Jesus thought it was corrupt, right? Here's the idea. Either you bought from the priest, or you had to deal with the priest-appointed inspector. Either way, the priests are going to get their money out of this. Everything purchased had a stout brokerage fee. It was a monopoly for the priest. And they took advantage of the poor and the faithful. That's sad, isn't it? No wonder Jesus was so upset when he walked into the temple and saw this going on in his father's house. We read in the Bible about a man by the name of Gamaliel. Gamaliel was one of the famous rabbis that taught. Gamaliel had a son. His name was Simeon, I believe. And so it was during this son's time that he finally had to put a stop to some of this. I think they call it price gouging. The price for a pigeon had gotten so ridiculous during the time of the Passover that he had to step in and say, enough is enough. And he had to cut the price back to where it was something that people could afford. They were sticking it to the people that needed it the most. And I think that's pretty sad. I remember a movie one time, a fella had car trouble. He was out in the middle of nowhere. There was only one mechanic. And he asked him, well, how much is this going to cost? And the mechanic goes, well, how much do you got? Because he didn't have any other options. And they're just going to stick it to you and take whatever they could take. And it might be $100, $200 for a pigeon. And old Gamaliel's son had to step in and say, listen, we have to stop this price gouging. We have to make this a fair and honest price. Whatever fair and honest means. But either way, I promise you, the priests were making their money. Okay, so let's go through the story again now. Acts 2, or John 2 rather, verse 13. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So it must have been after the 25th of Adar. Because the first 10 days, the money changers would have been outside the temple. Now they're in the temple. So we're getting close to the time of the Passover. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves. So set up there in the temple, outer court of the Gentiles. Imagine surrounding our building here, all these different vendors and all the different animals. We had to have oxen. Those are for the rich people. Those are the ones that could afford it. Then we had to have sheep or lambs. Those were the ones that couldn't afford the bulls. And then we had to have pigeons or doves. Those were for the poorest of the poor. All these people are now coming into Jerusalem, and they are now going to have to buy their animals from these priest-appointed vendors. Either that or have to bring their own animals, right, and have them inspected. So Jesus finds these. And the money changers doing business. That's a nice way of putting it. They were doing business. They were making some money. And when he made a whip of cords, and I don't know exactly what that means, somehow I guess he found something and started twisting it together, maybe found leather or some pieces of clothing. I don't know what he did. But when he found that whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. So he chases out all the sheep and the oxen out of the temple complex. You know, I always kind of imagine this happening very quickly. Now that I think about it, it probably didn't. It wasn't like clearing it out of this room. It was clearing it out of a complex. So it probably took a little bit of time to go around and chase all these animals out. Notice he didn't do anything with the doves. He chased out the sheep and the oxen and those that cared with them. He drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. Now he's going to turn his attention to the money changers. And he poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. I always thought, why was he harder on the money changers? You know, you chase your sheep, he just chased them out. He didn't do anything to them. But to the money changers, he walked up and he poured their money out and flipped that table over. And I imagine the money went everywhere, scattered. One, I'm sure he did it for effect. It's just the sound of that money just hitting the floor. But then I got thinking about it. What would those money changers then have to do? They would have to pick up every single coin, and then they would have to re-measure and re-weigh every single coin to make sure it was of the right denomination. So why did Jesus do that? Was it out of spite?
I don't know. But he certainly made his point by chasing those out of the temple and turning over the money changers' tables. Now, he hadn't said anything to anybody. So we've gotten rid of the sheep. We've gotten rid of the oxen. And we flipped over the table of the money changers. All we got left are the doves, right? And I'm sure as the people that are selling the doves are just sitting there with this look upon their face as Jesus has cleared out the temple, then what is he going to do to us? Well, he says something to those that have the doves. He says, take these things away and do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. So the only people he talked to apparently were those that sold the doves. He seemed to have a special little bit of indignation towards those that sold doves. Again, I wonder if it's because they were the ones taking advantage of the poor mothers. You can't get much lower than that. And then in verse 17, then his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house has eaten me up. So I wondered, what did the disciples think of all of this? Did they think that their leader was crazy? Did they think that he had lost his mind? Did they think he was bipolar? No, they said, oh, wait a minute. I remember a scripture. It's actually from Psalm 69. Psalm 69:9. Remember that scripture? Because zeal for your house has eaten me up, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. And so the apostles or the disciples realized there was reason for all of this. Jesus wasn't just crazy. Jesus didn't lose his mind. There was reason for all of this. What a scene that must have been in the temple that day at the time of the Passover. Did we answer all our questions? How many times did Jesus cleanse the temple? Some will tell you one. I tend to believe it's twice. Once at the first of his ministry, and then once again at the end. Where in the temple did this all occur? And probably not in the actual sanctuary itself, but probably in the outside, what was known as the court of the Gentiles. Number three, was there a need for animals during Passover? Yes, because people coming in from all over the world may not have opportunity to bring all these animals and across the journey. So it's easier just to buy the animals there at the temple. Number four, do doves represent peace? No, not in this time. Doves represented poverty. Why were money changers necessary? Well, you could only pay the temple tax in shekels. So you had to convert all of your money into the shekel. Now, it didn't say you needed to pay an exorbitant amount of fees and shipping and nominal fees. That was all invented by the priesthood. Was the system corrupt? Sure sounds like it, doesn't it? Sure sounds like it was corrupt. It appears to me that anytime money gets involved, corruption is just right around the corner. Sure enough, that's what happened. It looks like the priests were making a killing off of this with all of their nominal fees. And Jesus did not want to have any part of this. He said, you've turned this into a house of merchandise. You've turned the temple into Walmart. He said, that's not what it was supposed to be. That was not the design that God had for this idea. And number seven, what did the disciples think of all of this? They went back in their mind and thought about scriptures and said, oh yeah. Yeah, I remember that. My zeal for my house has eaten me up. That's what that was in reference to. Just as a sidebar, I thought about this. When we do something stupid, do we ever wonder what the people around us think about? Do any scriptures pop into their minds when they see the way we act? I know that might be kind of a scary question to think about. I know there are a lot of quotations there in the Old Testament about a foolish man and a foolish man with his foolish mouth and his foolish head. I wonder if people are going, oh yeah, that's a scripture I think of when I see how he acts. But hopefully people see kind of what we saw out of Jesus. The disciples, they didn't think he was crazy. They realized they had an understanding of why Jesus did what he did. Oh, that's what he meant in Psalm 69. That's what he meant, that his house was eaten before. That's a great story. Love that story of Jesus, and he cleansed the temple. I'll leave the remarks with you this morning. We never know the hearts and minds of those that are here. If there's any need to help with the church, we're ready to assist you at this time.